Washington a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia de Nijir Jilamujian para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia uigur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga vivos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sends out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Give me back my broken night, my mirrored room, my secret life. It's lonely here, there's no one left to torture. An order. Give me crack and careless sex. Take the only tree that's left and suffer up the hole in your culture. Give me back the Berlin Wall. Give me Stalin and St. Paul. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder. Gonna slide,
slide in all directions.
Won't be nothing you can measure anymore. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold and it's overturned the order of the soul. When they say, repent,
repent.
Repent. I wonder what they meant when they said.
private life will suddenly explode. There'll be phantoms, there'll be fires on the road, and a white man dancing. You'll see your woman hanging upside down, her features covered by her falling gown, and all your lousy little poets coming around trying to sound like Charlie Manson. Yeah, the white girl's dancing. Back the Berlin Wall, give me Stalin and St. Paul, give me Christ, or give me Hiroshima. Destroy the fetus now, we don't like children anyhow. I've seen the future, baby, it is Berta. Thing gonna slide. Won't be nothing you can measure anymore. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold and has overturned the border of the soul. When they say, repent, 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 I wonder what they mean. When they say, we'll be right back.
has a front row seat for the precious view. The latest war as a pay-per-view. Famine and disaster right in front of me.
And coming up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org and also on your archives on the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, it's Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides for, I guess we're in September now, 2023, and the date is the 21st. So this is a flashback you're going to be listening to. It's a flashback all the way back to February 10th, 2005. I gotta be playing a lot of music from the musical Inner City, which I still like and liked way back then, and that's the reason I played it at that point. You're going to be hearing some interviews from the street. We ran into Brian, who describes his difficult experiences with Santa Cruz CSO police officer Pam Bechtel. Then we hear Grant Wilson, who was at that time worked with Art and Revolution and the San Francisco Peace Coalition, later became a Santa Cruz 11 activist. That's the Occupy movement that gave the police and the district attorney the pretext to go after kind of troublesome activists who had nothing to do, really, with the nuts and bolts of the Occupy movement or the actual occupation of the vacant 75 River Street bank building, but who are sort of peripheral and being and supportive of it. And Grant was one of those, as was I. However, they got pretty serious back then, and I guess it's not clear they've really done that since in Santa Cruz. Though perhaps they haven't. I haven't been keeping my eye on the ball as much as I should. They charged us with two felonies and two misdemeanors for a total of 7 years in state prison had we been convicted, primarily of just being in the building when it was occupied by a group of folks protesting Wells Fargo Bank, which owned the building, and the community of Santa Cruz's leaders, the wealthier in the community or the more powerful in the community, who had no interest in community centers or shelters, structures for homeless folks. But this was sort of a symbolic protest in that way. Anyway, Grant and I are probably some of the most peaceful types around. We didn't know each other terribly well. I mean, we kind of were in different spheres of activism. I was in homeless civil rights, and he was involved in Art and Revolution, a group that did different kinds of skits that satirized large corporate connections that the city and the state and the country had with the plutocrats. You know, the money men. You also hear bits from Meriwether Mike, also known as Michael Pentecost. He's still around. He's an on-the-street musician and personality, I guess you'd say, who has lived his own independent lifestyle in spite of the anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz, often pretty much outside. Then you'll hear from Ralph Myberg of the group Scrap. Goodness knows what those letters are initials for. But this was an organization that fought the $66 million Santa Cruz Coast Hotel project, which they were successful in stopping. Then we'll have Mike Rhodes of Fresno. Even before Mike's victory in the lawsuit that won homeless people in Fresno for about a decade the right to sleep under bridges unmolested, I guess you might think that's not much of a victory. It was more of a victory than they had before, though, and they also, some of them got some money out of it, and of course the attorneys made a bundle. But this is Mike Rhodes in Fresno giving us an update. Then we have me reading an article from the Good Times about John Maurer, who's still around town. He's a fellow who had a Fuck the Pigs slogan in his hat as he sat on the pavement in front of the Palomar Hotel, or thereabouts, and he was concerned about harassment. He didn't just not like police. He had, I don't think he had anything against them. But one officer, again the same Pam Bechtel, who we hear about earlier from Brian, was giving him multiple tickets for such things as leaving his property while he went to the bathroom. And she was quite, I wouldn't say skilled, I might say more compulsive and passionate about giving tickets to people. She once, I believe she said to me, or maybe she said to someone else and it was reported to me, she just didn't feel good if a day went by when she didn't give out some tickets. So, and we interview a few panhandlers, get back to Mike, and you'll hear a lot of, as I said, music from the musical Inner City, and a few other bits of musical stuff as well. Not quite sure where they came from. They may be the next show, because this was the evening show, which was followed by Uncle Dennis's From the Cream to the Dregs. He was a mainstay of free radio, a man who loved the 60s and 70s music, or I think it was 60s and 70s, and he helped hold Free Radio Santa Cruz together. We don't really have much of that structure remaining. Some of it, I mean, I'm able to use some of their facility, that is to say some of their equipment, but we don't really have much of a collective anymore. A few people who still hang together, but we need more folks. So if you think you're interested in free radio, give me a call on the Huff line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 831-423-4833. And who knows, maybe we'll see a rebirth. I'm not holding my breath, though. So without further ado, I'll just go right into the February 10th, 2005 Bathrop Spears Broadsides flashback. You're going to have to wait until Sunday. I'm assuming I'll be doing another show on Sunday to hear our much beloved Sing Me a Song of Social Significance intro. But, maybe it'll be all the sweeter for the wait.
This is Free Radio Anytown. We scoff at the law. And now, here's millions of dead cops.
On your head.
You just have to knock.
We don't knock on criminals' doors, sweetheart, and we don't knock on yours. Now get down!
Okay, guys, round up the suspects.
What suspects? I'm the only one here. Why are they talking to the tape decks?
They are following the law. This radio station is under arrest.
You got a warrant?
Right here. It says we can arrest all equipment associated with your slimy little operation.
What are they doing on the roof?
Taking your antenna into custody. Love this job.
You know, I'd be happy to take it down for you.
Don't try to move, sweetheart. We got technology you haven't even dreamed of. And it's pointing right at your pretty little head. You guys got everything?
Transmitter, antenna, CD player, tape decks, turntable, computer, microwave oven, TV, toaster, juicer.
Not the juicer!
You think we'd leave anything behind so you could get back on the air? We're smarter than you think, you little commie.
Okay, boss. We got it all.
All right, let's go. Donut dreams open in 10. Come on, sweetheart. You got a date with justice. This true crime story happens all over America. Don't let it happen to you. Keep your ears clean, follow the rules, and stay off the airwaves. We may come knocking at your door.
And coming up next on Free Radio, Bathrop Spears, Broadsides, 2 hours of civil rights in your face and on the streets. Stay with us and jump into the studio with us.
Free
lullaby, baby, on the top floor. Project elevator won't work anymore. It comes up. Said that if I did, he'd knock my head with a teapot lid. Oh, school was dumb and the teacher mean. Along came a man in a limousine. I jumped inside, was off in a crack. Tell my mother I'll never come back. Tell my mother I'll never come back. Oh, tell everybody I'll never come back. Father and mother.
That's Inner City, a musical from the early 70s based on the controversial book The Inner City Mother Goose by Eve Miriam. She actually, the book was banned in numerous places, and she, however, Eve Miriam, who's now dead, is one of the most apparently widely published of nursery rhyme writers. It's all about, set in New York City in the early 70s. It was revived in the 80s. As Street Dreams. I'm going to be playing a few selections from it throughout this show. This is Bathrobs Pierre's Broadsides, as mentioned before, February 10th, 2005 show. I'm Robert Norse, and this is your radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz, the station without a license, without apology, broadcasting at 101.1 FM and at www.freakradio.org, streaming on the net. Phone line here is 831-427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. So give us a call. It's just me in the studio now, but you never can tell who might turn up. We have a strange panoply of hosts and co-hosts on my show that kind of make their way in. I'm expecting a number of phone calls. I'm going to make a few phone calls next hour. Mike Rhodes is an activist in the Central Valley who's going to be on the Homeless Marathon on Monday. That's the marathon, nationwide homeless marathon, where homeless people in different cities will be having, I think it's 18 hours long, something like that. It starts at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Valentine's Day, the 14th Monday, and runs through, 8 or 9 or 10 or something the next day. And HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and particularly the Human Rights Organization, both organizations concerned with restoring and establishing civil rights for homeless people in Santa Cruz and elsewhere, but particularly in Santa Cruz, that's where we're starting, are going to be kind of trying to serve as a contact point in Santa Cruz for this national marathon. And that's something you can do, you can join in on. You can listen to it. It's going to be broadcast by Free Radio Santa Cruz, much of it here on this station. It'll also be broadcast by KUSP, I believe. I think that's, isn't it KUSP 88.1, something like that, FM. You can call in to the Homeless Marathon. Anybody can call in. The call-in number is 1-877-NOBODY-8, 1-877-NOBODY-8, which is also 1-877-662-6398-8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless or about to become homeless, use a separate line, 1-866-LEFT-OUT, 1-866-LEFT-OUT, which is also 1-866-553-8688. Those are numbers I don't expect you to take because you probably don't have a pencil attached to your fingers. But if you give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, after tomorrow, I'm going to try to put a new message on the line, which hasn't been changed since November, I admit, and include those numbers so if people want to call into the Homeless Marathon, they can. You can also join Huff and the Human Rights Organization, I should say the Human Rights Organization, since they're the lead group doing this, and Huff. And we are currently looking for a place with a computer and a phone where we can, between 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock on Monday, accommodate a number of people to kind of be a part of telling the nation what's going on in Santa Cruz around homeless people. And if you want to be helpful, if you want to volunteer your space, or maybe I think actually we're willing to kick down some money for it, not a lot, but a little, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We need that, and we're looking for it. So think about that. That's Monday between 4 and 7 in the evening. And I'm also going to try to see if I can sneak into the studio during the marathon and maybe put in my 2 cents worth. Though it's all been pretty much set out in advance. There's a 1 hour comes from San Francisco, then another hour comes from Cincinnati, another hour from so forth. Different places that have already been prearranged, and I don't think Santa Cruz is part of that per se. But you can always call in on the Homeless Marathon. You can call in on this show anytime you want. It's 831-427-3772, or you can jump on the Internet and go to pagesincolor.com. That's the website in case, for example, someone is on the phone with me and you got a question for them, as might happen tonight, because, as I said, I'm expecting 3 different guests. One of them mentioned Mike Rhodes from the Central Valley. Another one is Ralph Myberg. Ralph, you've heard before. He's a very articulate opponent of the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel project, which passed the City Council 4-3 on Tuesday night, and which opponents, Ralph among them, have promised to put on the ballot as a referendum. And he may be giving us more information about that. Requires he get 5,000-7,000 signatures of registered city voters within 30 days of Tuesday, last Tuesday. So that's kind of quite a job. It was done with the De Anza people, who were then subverted by their own leadership, and they gave up on the referendum, even though they had the opportunity to do it. Hopefully this won't be a repeat of that. I actually favor holding city council members accountable, even though I'm not entirely decided on what kinds of projects are best for the economic development of the city. And Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization I'm a member of, decided and voted against this project and also voted in favor of the referendum at the latest Huff meeting because we felt it displaced the Clearview Court people, tied up affordable housing money and other funding, and was too risky a project and also had other negative impacts on the city. Plus, I think we thought it was being done with very bad process. That is to say, it was being done. A prefabricated plan was brought in. Apparently a developer was discovered by Scott Kennedy, Northwest Hospitality Group, and he kind of cooked up a deal with them, went through Dick Wilson, Seal Cirillo, and wham, bam, suddenly it was there, and that was that or nothing. You didn't have any choices. It was on the steamroller through. It was on the locomotive. And we're actually going to be hearing from the another side on this issue, Don Lane, who is a $1,200 consultant for the project. He admitted recently that he was paid to support the project. He's also a former mayor, and he's on the board of directors of the Homeless Resource Center. He will be coming into the studio between 10 and 11 on Sunday when I do the long show of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And that long show will have him on the air. Boy, I hope my volume levels are high enough. If you can't hear me on the radio, please do tell me, because I I don't want to be giving people, well, talking and having nobody listen. Looks like we have a phone call. Maybe I'll get some word on this. What's cooking here? Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, visitor?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. What's up?
Who is this?
This is Robert. You're on Free Radio.
Oh, am I?
Yep.
Oh, I called the wrong number. I apologize.
No problem, man. Bye-bye. All right. Well, wrong numbers happen. So there you are. But the number, in case you want the right number, it is, if you want to reach Free Radio, 427-3772. And give a call if you've got some thoughts. Or if our transmission isn't reaching you and you'd like to hear it better, or if there's some strange grumbling noise in the background or whatever, or if you want to grumble yourself, you know, give a call. So, as I said, we're going to have phone call guests. Guests by phone, Ralph Myberg, I mentioned, will be calling in, I hope. He's got a number of meetings he's running to arrange this referendum. Then he's going to give us an update from the city council meeting and from the community's reaction to what I and he and I guess other opponents of it regard as the ramrodding through of this project, the community's response, which will be, if he has any say in it, a referendum. He'll be calling in to talk about that. Also calling in will be Paul Sanford. Paul Sanford is a local attorney who has on occasion defended a number of poor people and a number of activists. He's defended me in the past. He's currently defending and pressing a civil lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, against the city and the police for their persecution and harassment of a homeless man named John Maurer. And I'll be talking about that a bit later. You can read about it in the Good Times. They've actually done, to their credit, two stories on John Maurer. One was about a year ago, maybe even more than that. The other just today came out. Maurer is the guy, and you've heard me talk about him, who had the little sign, "Fuck the Pigs," in his hat after he had been repeatedly harassed by police and wanted to make a point that he didn't like it and he was going to make it clear that's how he felt about it. He wasn't, you know, challenging them to a duel. He wasn't pulling out a gun and mace and, he wasn't assaulting them. He was simply stating his opinion of the kind of harassment he suffered as he sat near the Palomar Hotel from such people as CSO Pam Bechtel, the woman whose ticket book never met a homeless person she didn't like to ticket, apparently. At least many homeless people suffer from her harassing enforcement of both real and imaginary laws downtown. And so Paul should be reachable hopefully around 7:30. I'm going to try to call him and see if I can get a hold of him. And again, you can check out the current issue of the Good Times if you want to see what he's up to. So all that is coming up, and we've also got a number of interviews from the street to keep you abreast of what's happening, at least the kinds of accounts I'm getting when I talk to people down on Pacific Avenue. In fact, I think I'm going to find the appropriate, I think that's right here, actually, appropriate tapes. I'm going to start giving you what's cooking downtown. This is fairly recent, a few days ago, and, well, these folks speak for themselves, so check them out.
Well, it's about 2 o'clock here at the beautiful Pacific and Hoosie-Wetzel Street. What is it? Elm Street, I guess. Right across from Streetlight and at the Union Grove parking lot. We're talking to that old jailbird,
Brian.
And Brian, you're back. You've been criminal. I think you were picked up on a camping ticket some time ago.
Skateboarding ticket.
That was a warrant, or?
No, she gave me a skateboarding ticket, and I had a warrant out for a previous event, and so I went to jail for that.
What was the warrant for?
I think it was failure to appear.
Or?
Under the influence.
Okay. Now, how long were you in jail under the skateboarding ticket?
I was in for the first warrant for 5 days, and then they held me for another skateboarding ticket after I got previously released for that, and they held me over for a skateboarding ticket for another day and a half.
Skateboarding when you attacked several older women with your skateboard downtown?
Obviously, it had to be something like that.
What, in fact, was the skateboarding ticket about?
I skateboarded across the street.
Which street?
This one, right here.
Pacific Avenue.
Yeah.
Who gave you the ticket?
Pam.
M. Bechtel, the CSO.
Oh, yeah.
The Hungry Ticket book?
Yes, that one.
How many tickets has she given you now?
I'd say around 50.
And are you exaggerating? I mean, you actually, no. Can you count them? And what period of time?
Month and a half, 2 month period.
So how frequently would you say you get a ticket?
About one or two a week.
Okay, so that would make about... that would make about two per week for four or eight weeks would be about 16 tickets.
Well, I just got a whole bunch of tickets from her.
And what kinds of what in the main are you ticketed for?
Skateboarding, sitting on the sidewalk too close to a change meter, sitting too close to a person spanging. She gave me one ticket for I was walking past this lady and she was standing there. I said, hey, can you spare any change? And we were about 3 feet apart, which is the legal limit that you're supposed to do it.
Uh-huh.
And Pam comes up and she's like, no, 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 you're about a foot and a half away. You're about a foot and a half away from her. You were too close. I'm giving you a ticket.
There was no complaint, though, from the woman?
No, there was none.
Did the woman hear the conversation you had with Pam?
No, she didn't.
And where was this?
It was down in front of Graphics Pleasures.
And how long ago?
Week and a half.
And you probably don't keep these tickets, but they're probably mentioned on the computer. What's your full legal name?
Brian Joseph Shiro.
How do you spell last?
S-C-H-I-R-O.
Because I may check the computer to see how many tickets you got just to find out what the deal is. But you say that you had an unusual instruction from, because you're on probation now?
Yes, I am.
What are you on probation for?
Under the influence.
Under the influence of methamphetamines. Okay. What were you told by, and who told you what you just told me a few moments ago?
Officer Pam told me that if I get in any sort of skirmish, that she does, they don't care if I'm trying to self-defend myself or anything. If someone comes up and starts hitting me in the face, I'm not allowed to throw a punch or cause any physical harm to any human being, or it's a violation of my probation, and I go back to jail for 120 days.
And when did she tell you this?
About 3-4 days ago.
What was the situation? Outside, indoors?
Outside. I was just walking up to ask her what could I do if something happened, because a lot of people out here do not like me for things that have happened in the past, and skirmishes do tend to happen, and I was just wondering for self-defense purposes.
Okay. Well, as I was telling you, my understanding is that it's a lower standard of proof. If you're on probation or parole, particularly, I know much about parole, but probation, if you're accused of a crime, they don't have to give you a jury trial. They don't have to give you prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. They can have a hearing before a judge, and if they prove it, what's called a preponderance of the evidence, which means 51% of the evidence. If it looks like it could go either way, but it's a little more likely that you did it, then that's enough for the judge. Normally, you have to be proven guilty, not just beyond 51%, not just probable cause, but beyond a reasonable doubt, which is supposed to be a pretty high standard. Which means, you know, that they have to show pretty clearly that it really, really happened to 12 jurors. Most of the time, of course, it doesn't happen for 12 jurors. It happens as a plea bargain, because that's the kind of scene we got here with drug war prohibition bullshit going down.
Ever since I got on probation...
How long ago was that?
3-4 days. And, like, one couple nights ago, I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and I was trying to spange up. It was left or dark. I was doing that illegally. And the officer comes up to me, and so I...
Pam Bechtel?
No, the new female officer. I don't know her name. Uh-huh. But she comes up to me, and she's like, you can't do that. I'm like, okay. And I walked across the street, got some food. I was walking back across the street, and she starts coming over, and I said, I'm not in trouble, am I? And she's like, no, just watch how you're crossing the street, and fucking they're harassing me and shit.
Which street was this?
This one right here.
Pacific, where was that?
In front of the Metro, walking across to the Union Grove parking lot.
You have some reason to say because you just missed getting hit by a car? Or?
No, just because I was walking across the street and I'm on probation.
Well, I would say keep a record of your contacts with the police. If you can, buy a little notebook with a pen and write the time it happens, the police officer, what happened. and then just, you know, keep a notice of it. Then if you ever get called before a judge, you might be able to say, look, or you could even take it initially yourself before, well, it's kind of hard to do, but, you know, you can certainly bring it to me, and I can talk about it on the radio, whatever that's worth. It's not going to help you. They'll still send you back to jail, but nonetheless, you know.
But
hey, anything happening today? It's a sunny day after the rain here.
No, nothing really. Just having a good day. No cops. Haven't been harassed. Nothing. Just having a good day. Trying to make money for a motel room. Well, good talking to you.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Good luck. Good luck, man.
Yeah.
One of the projects that Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, talks about, and who knows, may eventually get into, is Copwatch. And Copwatch, which is kind of has periodic crests and troughs here in Santa Cruz, periods of activity and inactivity. The table downtown that Huff staffs every Wednesday and Thursday nights, and there's one down there tonight if you've got complaints about how you've been treated or if you've got some commendations about police officers and merchants and how you've been treated, please go to the Huff table and talk to the Huff people there. It's right in front of Borders at Soquel and Pacific Avenue. And there's actually a new flyer out on the Huff table about what happens if they tow your vehicle for parking tickets. Yon Golder, who's been probably had more hassle with his vehicle than many here in Santa Cruz, put together a flyer for Huff that actually asks more questions than it answers, but does answer a few and is really looking to get some feedback from the community. If you've had your vehicle taken, if you've had your vehicle threatened, you might be interested in this. We don't have copies of this flyer, but the flyer is posted at the Huff table down at Pacific and Soquel, and hopefully the copies of the flyer will be out next week. It's also posted on the internet at indymedia.org, www.santacruz.indymedia.org. You can check the article there, which is a sort of a pretty much the same thing as the printed version of the flyer. The flyer is a little more colorful. It's got a great picture of a toad with a police hat on, which is how many of us view some of the parking attendants in town, although it's nothing personal. It has to do with the kind of nasty job they're assigned to do. So you can check out Huff. The Huff table, again, as I said, used to have a Copwatch element to it. There was a Copwatch shared the Huff table on Thursday evenings, but Copwatch is kind of moribund, meaning it's, well, it's not dead, but it's kind of sleeping, if you will. But I believe a lot of Huff members and other folks on the streets are keeping their eyes open with respect to police, hosts, private security guards, little merchant vigilante groups that are running around harassing people either downtown or on the west side. And it's really important for us to share information on these issues. If you see people being harassed, if you're being harassed yourself, please call the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and leave us an account. It doesn't mean we can run in and help you, although in some cases we might be able to do something. You can also come to a Huff meeting at Baker Square, 8:30 in the morning on Wednesday, every Wednesday, at 1107 Ocean Street at Baker Square Restaurant. Goes from 8:30 to 11 in the evening. And you can also check out the kind of Huff Safe Street Performers musical celebration that happens every Wednesday night from 6 to 10 and really is going strong, amazingly enough. I think we had our 54th weekly one last night. And I just, I keep telling myself, what am I doing at these crazy musical events? I can't play an instrument, and I want to be doing something else. I'm sitting at a table where nobody's looking or doing anything with political action. But in a way, it's an ongoing phenomenon that's really amazing. People get fed there. People get cheered up there. People share and swap stories and company there. It's a good thing. And I really hope that it evolves into people are encouraged to reclaim public space at other times downtown. We have a lot of our work cut out for us with people like Pam Bechtel, who is really kind of, it's not that she is such an evil creature or individual. She's just an ordinary person, you know, but she's a person in a police uniform, a community service officer uniform, who I'm getting habitual reports of harassment. I've also seen her make up laws as she goes, both in court and out of court. And I'd be happy to document that, you know, for her, giving her time. I mean, she knows about it. I tell her when it happens. And she kind of, you know, walks off with her chin up in the air and doesn't really address the issue. I think she feels she's doing the right thing. The trouble is that it hurts a lot of people. And it creates an atmosphere of fear on the streets, and it discourages the use of public spaces. So it's bad, and it's good that we fight it. And I encourage people to continue to do that. And while we're all getting ready to do some more fighting, here's a little music to fight by.
This is the love of the nation.
Talking with Grant Wilson, first night maestro from a year ago, but no first night this year for Art and Revolution or the Santa Cruz Peace Coalition.
That's right. Robert, you are so informed.
On top of it. Why is that?
Well, I think it just happened to be maybe in part just the energies of the groups this year, but I think it's also that groups certainly haven't felt all that welcome. Certainly political groups have officially been unwelcomed by first night. So I think that that's not a great feeling to feel like it's a community event and certain groups that maybe have political agendas are not welcome.
Are you suggesting Art and Revolution has a political agenda?
Well, it's a little undercover. Those giant puppets are kind of the facade, but yes.
You may have seen that people have been showing up with signs downtown saying end the war. And I don't know, every Sunday, I guess for 3 hours up here on the corner, did you notice there was a couple of folks, Dave Espinoza and others, are walking about with signs and you know, shouting in SUVs, get lost, and getting responses. Do you see any kind of a change in the temperature of the town as far as opposition to the war goes? I mean, it's been pretty tepid for the last year.
As you speak, I notice the fog is coming in, actually. So I think you're right. Its grayness is descending upon this town, and that's really a shame. And I think that, people really need to, and us as individuals really need to...
So you don't see a change. You see the ongoing grayness continuing?
Mm-hmm. I think it's coming in a little more, actually, as we speak. So I think we have our work cut out for us on that front.
I see. So you don't see any shift in the wind yet?
I don't, but, you know, I'm not a weather vane, so maybe I'm just
doesn't
one.
Doesn't take a weatherman.
That's true. Well, I could be part of the weather underground, but...
Any events coming up for Art and Revolution or other groups around opposition to the war or other local issues you might want to mention?
Well, I guess I'll just mention something that just happened, which was the
counter-inauguration,
which you probably already covered, but just the fact that I was actually really inspired and really pleased that with over 300 people showed up for that event. So we had created a giant Statue of Liberty puppet, and
did you get a permit?
We had a sound permit, as far as I know. I mean, it was a coalition of groups, so I don't know like what everybody was doing everywhere with that. But I know at least...
You make sure not to block traffic.
Yeah, I think when we stuck to the sidewalks and we crossed at the intersections, and yeah, I think
didn't alarm the horses, and it was everything was under control.
Yeah, there weren't any horses to alarm, which was probably good, and I probably rather alarm motorists than horses. But yeah, it actually was not
any intersection.
We didn't block any intersection.
No die-ins. It was a temperate event.
A temperate event, yes. It wasn't totally gray, I would say, but I think it actually, what I actually did enjoy and appreciate about it was that a lot of people did, to some degree, take to the streets and...
To the sidewalks.
Yes. I mean, they got up off of sofas and out of cars and off of bicycles, and they participated, and I think that's inspiring. I mean, because... a lot of people don't do that. And even when there's very just and, as you know, very just and important causes, there can be a very neutral...
Inauguration comes but once every 4 years. This will be happening then every 4 years. There'll be an anti-war protest of this sort. You promise?
No promises, but time will tell. Yes.
What's coming up next for Art and Revolution? For those who wish to join you or benefit from your experiences or plot some new devilishment, what should they do?
Well, I would recommend that people come to our monthly Art and Revolution meeting, which is at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. It's the second Tuesday of every month at 7:30. And they can find out what's going on that way, or they can call us at 426-2292. To get information. That's 426-2292. And I know that we are probably planning something for March, I think it's at 19th, which is the anniversary of the start of this latest Gulf War. So I think that will be an opportune time to put some more...
I'll relax for the next month and a half until March 19th and get ready to come out on the sidewalks for another...
Maybe even off the sidewalks. Who knows?
You don't want to get too radical. That might cause problems.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
You had about 300 people, but you felt that wasn't enough to take the streets.
Well, I kind of felt like it was a coalition thing, and I wasn't going to be the one to, like, block the cars. I had a giant Statue of Liberty. I had to liberate the Statue of Liberty. So I had my hands full, and so it just didn't happen. And I think
that... Flame of Freedom burned, but not too bright.
Nobody got burned by the Flame of Freedom.
What a nice way you have of putting it. I know that when Huff did a memorial for Robert Wagner, all 13 strong, we blocked the street, marched up Pacific Avenue. As you may know, because I believe, I don't know if you were in the parade, but Brandt, I know, was.
Oh, good, good. You know, I think that really, I think that speaks to the fact that they're, you know, the value of quality, not quantity. So I think there is also, always in crowds of, large or small, there's opportunities to do civil disobedience or take action and step off the curb. And I think that's very valid and important stuff. But it's often, in some ways, up to individuals or the group to do that.
And, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with Grant Wilson of Art and Revolution, the man behind the Statue of Liberty, or certainly one of the women and men behind the statue. Check out Art and Revolution. Again, it meets every second Tuesday of every month at the...
Resource Center for Nonviolence.
At 15 Broadway.
That's right. And, I'll just maybe mention a little side note with the Statue of Liberty. One thing that we learned with the original Statue of Liberty is that it actually arrived in the U.S. Of course, it came from that...
La Paire France.
Oh, unmentionable
French
country.
Fries.
Right,
the American
Freedom Fries country.
It came from freedom in Europe. Yeah.
The Free Fries country, and as a gift to the United States. And actually, the statue had her legs were manacled. There were chains around her legs. And the officials of the U.S. government at the time, I think that was in the late 1800s, had actually that portion of the statue sent back to France and had it remade to remove the shackles and the chains. Apparently, the shackles and chains were symbolic of America's history with slavery, but
they wanted
apparently
to be completely have truth in advertising, and since they were denying slaves the vote regularly and lynching them, they figured that would be, inaccurate.
Yes. Yes.
So that shows honesty on the part of our authorities. I think there's far too much criticism of them these days, and perhaps there was then.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. More to that. There's lots more.
Interesting historical note. Thank you, Grant.
Hey, thank you, Robert. Have a good day.
I'm standing in front of 1010 Pacific Avenue next to a man with a bag, a teddy bear peeking out of the bag, a guitar in a guitar case, another paper bag, a number of blankets, and, of course, his traveling shopping cart umbrella stand. What? And you're reading some kind of a publication. What are you reading there, sir?
Oh, this is called The Daily Word for Inspiration and Thinking Good Thoughts for Yourself and Others.
And, of course, we're talking with...
My name's Michael Pentecost.
And, Michael, you're a man... Some people have called Merry Weather Mike, although the weather doesn't look more foggy than Merry at the moment. You've been playing music on the streets now for at least a year and running around with this group of questionable street performers. I hear you have your 52nd year annual festivity coming up on Wednesday.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. I think it's not this Wednesday, but next or something. I don't know.
I think it is in 4 days.
The first Wednesday of February.
Oh, really? It isn't this Wednesday? I thought it was the 55th. This was the...
I'm not sure.
A man to whom schedules are, should we say, sometimes vaguer than...
Sketchy, yeah.
Sketchy schedules. So anything on the street, any reports about things you've seen you wish to pass on to the community?
I'm always put on the spot, always short of a thought, but I'm sure in a minute or two I'll...
But that sounds like a rhyme to me, I must say.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not suggesting there necessarily is anything newsworthy. You may just be, looks like you're a little chilly. You've got sufficient clothing. It's a little cold here.
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. Just about half asleep, I think.
Maybe you should go back, because I don't mean to interrupt a meditative session that you're engaged in.
Oh, no, I was just sitting here. Valerie's supposed to come by. I don't know if she's got to work late or what. Just kind of dozed off, I think. But,
that's Valerie Christie of the... Safe organization,
my
fellow performer.
Another safe devotee, as you might say. And, So
at the moment, however, you're a man who has no particular... I see you have a Bugs Bunny chair here, kind of a portable chair.
And we will leave behind the Bugs Bunny chair and this apparently rather... limited content of that interview, because on the line with us we have Ralph Myberg of Scrap. Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Robert.
Oh, there. Sorry.
How are you?
A bit loud there. I'm sorry to all our listeners. Say something else, Ralph.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
That's good. I'm lowering the volume so we won't be blasted out.
Okay.
And say something else.
This is normal. Does that sound okay?
That sounds great.
Okay.
So, Ralph, you've been in the studio at least twice, and you've been keeping a pretty close tabs on the City Council's 4-3 advocacy for the Northwest Hospitality Group?
Yes.
That's the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel $66 million project, which is touted as being a salvation for unions and social services alike. Are you taking a different view on this?
I think that this is not really an issue about union labor, although I support union labor, and there are many other projects in the pike, including the La Bahia Hotel, the Louis Rittenhouse property downtown, the Natural History Museum building, the building by the Monterey Bay visitor the Exploration Center, some of which I have actually helped bring on board. So we're certainly not against construction or labor unions getting the jobs. We are against this site being proposed for a very large hotel development and for the conference center shell that the city proposes to build, and a six-level parking garage in a site that is actually expressly restricted under the old BSOL plan. And my concern is that this all combined just seeks to de facto overthrow our own local policy and effectively returns us to pre-Coastal Act days, where municipalities were free to exploit commonly held precious coastal resources for for profit and overwhelming development, and that's really what this is all about.
Ralph, why should this show is about poor people, and I know I always bring you back to this, but I have to because that's
no,
where
I
our focus.
That.
Why should we give a damn if this bothers the people on the west side, increases their traffic, if this is something that you know old time supporters who couldn't give a damn about homeless people and who have the police regularly rouse them from the west side, who set up signs on the west side that deny them the right to even park their vehicles, much less to be able to sleep in their vehicles. I mean, those who are pressing this project are saying, look, there are going to be low-income jobs for people, more jobs. There's going to be more social service money coming in. This is going to increase the business situation in the town. And, you know, even if we don't necessarily buy all of that, should poor and homeless people join in this struggle, or do you think that it's something that really we should leave to folks on the west side who've got some time on their hands?
Actually, there were two or three things in that, Robert, so I have to address them. The whole issue of homelessness is very complicated, so I can't go into that in detail personally. But what I would say is that the coastal resources, fresh air, spaces for people to gather, to be free from the bombardment of urban life and emissions and all that stuff, I mean, that's common to all economic classes. Health matters of that type, traffic bombardment, especially on commonly held coastal resources, is just something that cuts across all classes. So just to keep it there, I don't think this is strictly an issue of wealthy West Side neighborhoods. I know the neighborhood that I live in is a neighborhood that has, I'm sure, wealthy people, has large houses, has very small houses, it has rentals, has students, there's longtime people here. So I wouldn't just classify the neighborhood in one way or another. Real estate values are very high in Santa Cruz across the board. I can't justify that or talk about that in any real detail. But I do know this, that the low-income housing that is closest to the project, and that's the Clearview Court, that is most directly threatened by the six-story parking garage. The only opening to the parking garage is an opening that directs emissions and noise and light directly into Clearview Court. So, you know, in terms of concern about people that are relatively low income, yeah. But, you know, my concerns are, I guess, larger than that, but that's certainly a large component.
Wait,
Robert, the one other thing, because you brought it up.
Well, I did, but try to hold that thought, because I want to talk about Clearview Court for a minute. I'm going to give you a chance.
Okay, it was just on the jobs thing, because you brought
that
up.
Okay, quickly, though, so we don't lose the Clearview Court issue, because I think that's an important one. The Clearview Court situation, you know, they were fighting to keep their rent control. And I didn't see one West Side resident out there helping them a year ago when they were struggling to do this. I saw West Side residents trying to help the De Anza people. And I know that a lot of us felt that when the Clearview Court people were being attacked, that this rent control attack was part of the process of dismantling Clearview Court with an eye to a project such as this Northwest Hospitality Group thing. But I mean, and I know the Clearview Court people definitely agree with you that they don't want the quality of their lives destroyed or cheapened. Although it looks like there was kind of a surrender in progress the other night at City Council, where now they're kind of dickering, well, how much money can we get from Northwest Hospitality and the City Council to move us along?
I don't think that's the right interpretation of that.
Okay,
money being offered as a mitigation, and when you analyze it, you didn't know when that would begin. Would most people who could have some mitigation through this money have long gone because they've had to deal with the oppressiveness of construction in their backyards for 2 or 3 years? And the noise and the light and stuff like that, they didn't know exactly when even this, what I consider a relatively paltry offer to try and, you know, mitigate their circumstance. When would that kick in, and how would it be allocated, and over how many years? Did it sound a lot better than it actually was, even though it wasn't acceptable? I haven't seen a buy-in on the basis of that mitigation. I think the council members correctly feel guilty about what happened to Clearview in the past, and the additional hammer that's coming down on them now that they are totally responsible for. And I think this was a way to solve their conscience and to a degree attempt to buy out the very fierce opposition to this project that exists amongst Clearview residents.
Okay. And you had something about the jobs you wanted to
comment on? Yeah, you had mentioned, you know, jobs for low-income people. Now, I'm obviously very supportive of jobs for people at every level, and we have promoted ideas and continue to do that to produce jobs. The build-out of the Lubber here is certainly something that will provide a lot of jobs. The other buildings I mentioned will provide jobs. What will not provide jobs are projects that overreach, like the old beach south of Laurel Plan that the community fought to a standstill. So for me, in terms of productivity, you need to come through with projects that don't overreach and projects that enjoy the consensus or a real support basis in the community, not just a segment of the community. Segments of the community tend to divide against each other and fight things to a standstill. That's not how you provide jobs.
Can you, Ralph, can you give us a look back at the last year? There are those who say that this project has been, and I made this comment at City Council, I'm one of them, I said my understanding, and it's a limited one, I want to know what your opinion is, that this was a prefabricated project that was sort of shoved forward as a package without any meaningful public involvement at the real grassroots planning stage. Is this a fair criticism, or am I being unfair to the council?
No, I feel that's fair. I've spoken to people that are very active in the community, and they did not really get wind of this project till late on in the process. The other thing about it, even for people that had some sense that this project was going through, it was going through such dramatic design changes, such dramatic expansions and contractions, that there never was anything to really talk about. The closest we've had to something to talk about, it was 2 weeks ago at the City Council, or at the most a month ago, when the proponents organized to sell this to the community, but those proponents had already sold it to their own constituency over about a year and a half.
Councilmember Tony Madrigal, when approached on this issue about 2 weeks ago, said to me that he initially heard about this way back in 2003 in November, and that there had been a process that had been going on ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I have for you is, has there in fact been such a process where people have been, you know, discussing with redevelopment agency staff and other members of the planning commission what would be good and why this location
No.
should be done?
Not at all. Actually, if this process had any sense in it, we wouldn't be throwing money at it, because basically it's an ongoing waste of our money that is sustaining a distorted backward process. The first thing that was needed in this process was a Coastal Commission decision regarding the acceptability of massive design guideline changes. And until that's in, until the Coastal Commission either agrees to these egregious changes or modifies them to some level that the hotel might or the city might not feel acceptable in order to carry out the project, or flatly denies it, until that decision is reached, there's no sense in having anything go forward, because everything hinges on that decision. So the city has really taken the attitude, let's put this together as an all or nothing project, let's steamroller it through the community, try and pick up a 7-0 vote at the city council, and then try and steamroll this through the Coastal Commission. I should say in very definitive terms that the proponents of this project are severely hampered now and severely disappointed that they don't carry a 7-0 council majority. I'm very proud of the three people that have asked for additional community input and have seen this process as severely flawed, and are now beginning to see that some of the very strong arguments raised by the community are really valid, and we need to provide answers before anything happens. And then the bottom line is the ultimate decision-making body is the Coastal Commission, and the Coastal Commission staff made very clear to the city that they should first go ahead and see what the Coastal Commission has to say about their proposed guideline changes. And they're not small. They're asking for a non-conforming structure be increased by
Let's not go into the details.
Hang on.
But because I think that we're actually, you know, you're going to have an opportunity to, in a way, debate this with one of the proponents, who's actually a paid consultant, Don Lane, who he's agreed to come on the air at 10 o'clock on Sunday. That's, you know, 3 days hence here on Free Radio to present his point of view. He's insisted that no opponents be in the studio, and he, of course, declined to call in when you were in the studio, but I'm hoping that you will call in to, you know, engage in a dialogue with him.
Well, I'll try to, Robert. I have to check scheduling and stuff, but I certainly am interested
in correcting
any points that he makes that are misleading, and they, in my mind, they have made numerous misleading points.
If you can't call in, maybe you can, you know, find somebody else who is equally knowledgeable who might be able to call in as well. That's going to begin 10 o'clock
Sunday. I did want to update you where the process is now, besides the question you asked.
Yeah,
is
what's happening
relevant at this point?
Yeah, please, give us. Scrap has been meeting and scrapping around.
Yes.
That's the Santa Cruzans for Responsible
Planning.
Planning. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Actually, I'd like to even go further. I'd like to say that we're right in the midst now of setting up a basis for collecting signatures to put this matter up for a referendum. We feel most certainly that because of the $66 million of public money that's being set aside for this project, against the advice of, for example, the very respected Brookings Institution has warned municipalities about untenable risk of investing into conference centers. But for all the reasons that we oppose this project, don't really want to get into, that we want the community to judge. We think that the coastal policy is being undermined. We think that there's a mad rush to traffic congestion, neighborhood impacts, commercialization of Westcliff and Cowles Beach community. We think the process is totally flawed. And we have other issues, but we really bottom line feel that this is something that rises to the occasion where the people of Santa Cruz should be allowed to address this issue. And for all the reasons that I put, it shouldn't be hinged on the vote of a single council person, although I'm very confident that the Coastal Commission will rebuff them, the massive changes they're proposing. The Coastal Commission staff has certainly supported our position on that, or vice versa. So now, in terms of a grassroots campaign to gather signatures, Bill Malone at 420-1133 is coordinating that issue. We're looking for volunteer signature gatherers.
420-1133. That's Bill Malone for the initial. This is a referendum on a city council measure that's already passed 4-3, right?
That's right, and the referendum will seek to rebuff that 4-3 decision, rendering this untenable. So basically, negate the city council's decision with a vote of the community. You know, the city manager said this was the biggest event in Santa Cruz history since the founding of the university. And so even by his language, which might be a little hyperbole, this deserves to go to the people. There's too many issues here. There's too much. We're fighting for the soul of Santa Cruz in many ways. We're certainly concerned about the investment and all the other things I've spoken about. So we need to raise money to, you know, for printing costs, for gathering signatures, and for information. We also need volunteer signature gatherers. So I gave you Bill Malone's number, and he's coordinating signature gatherers. I'd like to give you a P.O. Box number if anyone feels that they would like to donate money to this effort. It's truly a grassroots effort. And that number is, you can make checks out to SCRAP, SCRAP or SCRP, whichever way you choose. It's at send your money to P.O. Box 7564, Santa Cruz 96051. And all amounts matter. You know, as I say, these we do need a cash basis for printing costs and for other reasons. So we appreciate people who feel strongly on this issue contributing to the effort.
Ralph, are there any debates or discussions coming up on this subject publicly? And do you have any literature which people can get a hold of if they're uncertain what to do? I mean, are you going to have a table downtown at a particular place where people
can sign all of that, Robert. And that's why Bill Malone is, together with other people that are a subcommittee from SCRAP, are going to be coordinating that effort. And
that's Bill Malone.
We've just begun printing.
That's Bill Malone at 4-20-1133.
That's right.
Now, you know, I said a moment ago that that Don Lane, a former mayor and advocate for this project, and I believe a paid consultant, at least by what he said at a recent People's Democratic Club meeting for the project, will be coming on the air here in the studio at Free Radio to talk about it. I said 10 o'clock. I'm not sure if it's 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, so I apologize to folks. I'm a little uncertain about this. I'm going to try to get clear confirmation about that, but it's definitely going to be on Sunday morning between 10 and 12. So for those of you who want to hear the other side or who want to challenge the other side, that's the time to call in and talk. Any comments about what you heard at the city council meeting on Tuesday night, Ralph? You stayed through that rather long final vote and discussion. Did anything come out there that you think had not been out there before?
No, not really. What I do notice overall is there's a lot of people that have come out and expressed their needs, and they're legitimate. You know, the SEIU and other unions want jobs, they want raises. There were people there that feel that if they had apprentice programs that would benefit their children, that just having more jobs in the community might allow people to buy into the community. You know, all very legitimate concerns. People from the arts feeling that this will help the arts prosper. People from the social services that talk about money infusion into the general plan. All coming out there, and I'm just reminded pretty much of DiCenzo's cartoon where all these people stand around looking at the goose waiting for it to lay the golden egg.
That's the cartoon in the Metro.
In the Metro, yeah. And, you know, we're talking, if projections are correct, once you remove the debt that is incurred in this entire process, and we're not talking about infrastructure costs from development. We're talking about the most optimistic kind of projections of the city getting $500,000 a year out of this. Now, certainly that money will not satisfy anything near what these groups need. We do have a plan, though, that will, and this hotel development might actually interfere with what would be the most common sense thing the city could do at this point, and that is go to the voters. You only need 50% vote and raise the TOT, which is the transient occupancy tax.
We've talked about this on other shows.
Yeah, I'm going to have to
wind you up
because it's important for people to know.
Ralph, I'm going to have to wind it up here because
sure.
I've got someone calling in at 7, and we're a bit late already. But you're welcome to call in again. Of course, the show goes till 8, and you also are welcome to call in on Sunday.
I'll try on Sunday after Don Lane's had his say.
Oh, I would encourage you to call during the Don Lane discussion so you can have some ask him some questions and respond to some of his thoughts, so he can respond to some of yours as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, if I'm available, I will certainly try to do that. I enjoy debate, and I always find that to be enlightening and informing for the community.
Or at least amusing, if nothing else. Hey,
yep.
Thank you, Ralph. And again, for those who are interested, give a call to Bill Malone at 420-1133 for more information and to help with the referendum.
Thank you.
Bye. And that was Ralph Myberg, and this is Free Radio at 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. We're going into our second hour, and I'm actually kind of hoping for a call from Mike Rhodes, who's kind of scheduled to be calling in from the Central Valley, where he actually, I believe he has been on a trip to Brazil to one of the economic conferences down there and has had some rather interesting experiences with homeless folks down in Sao Paulo, which is, of course, a huge city and massive differences in poverty and wealth. I've just learned that it was, in fact, 10 a.m. that Don Lane, the proponent of the Santa Cruz Hotel, is scheduled to come in and speak here in the studio on Sunday, February, I guess it's the 13th. So, you know, mark that on your calendar if you want to hear the other side. We haven't actually had a proponent speak at any length on the air, and that'll be an opportunity for that to happen. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Mike in Fresno.
Hey, Mike. I was just talking about you.
I heard. I was listening on the Internet.
Oh, excellent. You know, I have not been able to reach the website that you mentioned, so I'm kind of going at this cold, but that doesn't mean we can't have an interesting conversation. You're an activist in Fresno?
Correct, yes. I'm in Fresno in the Central Valley.
But you've been cavorting down in Brazil as well?
Just got back last Thursday, from a trip to Brazil to attend the World Social Forum, which was in Porto Alegre. The World Social Forum is this event that happens once a year. People from all over the world come to it. These are political activists, people in unions, in community groups, and we get together and compare notes. It's a lot of fun.
And how long were you down there for?
We were there for about 3 weeks. The forum itself was 4 or 5 days, but we were there on a global exchange tour, meeting with some of the groups in Brazil both before and after the event. And as you know, as I talked to you the other day, we met with a group of homeless people in Brazil and talked about some of the solutions they've come up with in their struggle to have a decent life.
Yeah, what was the extent of your contact there?
Well, we went to a land takeover. The homeless people in Brazil are really well organized. They're in a group called the Movement for Land, the Landless Workers Movement. It's the MST. And what they do is these are people that have been taken off of the land. They were agricultural workers, and they, you know, have been removed from the land and shifted, pushed into the slums and the favelas in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. And it's the poverty there is just so intense and so grinding, and these people have a connection with the land. And
you know, that, Mike, that sounds like, I was reading recently The Assassination of Julius Caesar by Michael Parenti.
Oh, okay.
Which is a book about Roman history. It sounds like exactly what happened to Roman farmers. Large corporations bought up the land, forced the farmers off the land, so they became poor people who migrated to the cities, and they lived in grinding poverty.
Yeah.
And, of course, they became, you know, soldiers because they had, you know, they had to go out and earn their living somehow, or they just became, got on the dole, and they became, you know, it was circuses, bread and circuses there in Rome. Go ahead.
Well, in Brazil, they've sort of become an army in a sense, but not like a Roman army. They have organized themselves, and they find land that is not being cultivated, and there's a lot of issues with the land in Brazil as to who owns it. Some of it's owned by the government. Some of it, large landowners say that they own it, but it's very tenuous. It's like, well, yeah, it's ours, but, you know, they don't have land title because their family had gotten the land by stealing it from the Indians, the indigenous people in Brazil. And so while they have possession of the land, they don't necessarily have title to it. So this landless peasant movement, landless worker movement in Brazil, moves like 100 to 200 families. And it is families. It's not just the workers, but the whole families move onto the land and take it over. And this has happened all over Brazil in all of the states in the country, and there's approximately 1 million people involved in the movement at this point. They've been doing this for about 20 years now, and they have taken over huge tracts of land, and the government basically comes in and sanctions it. After a couple of years, they have title to the land, and it is theirs, and they have formed cooperatives and collectives on all this land. So it's an incredibly huge movement, probably the biggest popular movement in South America, and is just really effective at doing what they do. It's a great solution for homeless people to have a decent life.
Sounds like, in a way, like the old West in the United States, homesteading, but in those days, they stole land from Native Americans. Are they stealing land from Native Brazilians? Or?
Actually, it's kind of the opposite of that, that they're very respectful of the Native lands, the indigenous people's lands. They do have, the indigenous people do have land of their own there, and the landless workers' movement is very careful not to step on those toes. They're taking the land of large landowners and land that the government owns that's not being cultivated. And so I had the opportunity to go out to one of these land takeovers and talk to some of the people there about their circumstances and what led them to this point in their life. And it was that story about being moved off of the land. They used to work on farms, and for a variety of reasons, largely because of mechanization or a growth in the corporate takeovers of the land, they were pushed off of the land and had no other option but to move into a city. And then they came in contact with this MST, the Movement of Landless Workers, and they said, you know, this is what we're doing to make a better life for ourselves.
I know that Brazil was, you know, the place where the right-wing death squads began their reign of terror in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, there was some hope when what Lula was elected a year or two ago.
Two years ago.
Now his boys are over there marching around in Haiti shooting the Haitian peasants. So, I don't know, I'm a little bit, you know, don't know which team to root for. What do you think?
root for the popular movement and the organization that has gone into the taking over land from these large landowners and from the government. Lula is a really interesting case because he's, you know, he came from the union movement. He's like, you know, this union leader. He's considered by most people there a socialist.
Lula is the president of Brazil, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Right, go ahead.
And so people, when they elected him 2 years ago, had huge hopes that things would change for the poor and working people in that country. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the amount of change that Lula has been able to implement. And that dissatisfaction runs through the entire left in Brazil. I think that people still support him, but they're very critically supporting him and trying to push him in the right or the left direction, as the case may be, to do the right thing. People feel that he's paid too much attention to the concerns of the IMF and the World Bank, and he hasn't listened closely enough to the needs of the people.
Mm-hmm. But that's, are they, you know, is there any... Is there any actual prospect of that, or is this a sort of a, you know, I mean, some people wanted to push Kerry to the left, which looked like, you know, a contradiction in terms in the U.S., since he was out, you know, out jingoing Bush on Iraq. So what are the prospects of that?
Well, you know, you have an entirely different situation there. It was the left that elected Lula to power. It'd be like if we were to elect David Cobb from the Green Party as the president of the United States, you'd have a lot of hope there, right?
Or Ralph Nader. Perhaps.
Or Ralph Nader, mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah. You know, somebody who is identified with the left and, you know, stands up, at least rhetorically, against the corporate domination and has plans to do something about that. These people had enormous hope. The people that I talked to in the MST were just terribly disappointed in the results of the Lula election, and they were like, you know, it's really been a lesson in putting your hopes and aspirations and all the work you do into electing a single leader, because that's not enough.
That happened some time ago, too, right?
2 years ago.
Now, let me just say this. We're talking with Mike Rhodes of Fresno. Mike, have you got a website people can go to? And if you have questions for Mike, you can't call into the studio phone because we got one line, but you can go to pagesincolor.com and ask him questions on that chat room. But if people want to kind of get more information about this, have you posted anything around this issue?
Yeah, I was writing articles like a madman while I was down there and posting them on our website. And that's at www.indiebay.org. That's an indie media site, and it's the Bay Area indie media site. And if you go there, there's a, on the left-hand side, there's a Central Valley button. Click on that, and you'll see on the center page a whole series of articles about the World Social Forum, including articles about the homeless in Brazil.
Yeah, I see this. The World Social Forum comes to a close. That's at www.indiebay.org/Central Valley.
Yeah,
or you can click on Central Valley if you want to check that out.
Robert, I wanted to tell you, too, that when I was talking to the homeless people, these people in the MST who were in the process of a land takeover, after the interview, I was talking to them, and they said, now, tell us about your country. Do you have homeless people there? And I said, yeah, of course we do. And that in Fresno, there's something like 20,000 homeless people in the community that I'm from. And they were surprised by that. And they said, well, and how are these people treated? What's their life like? And are they doing anything like what we're doing here? And I was sad to tell them about the conditions that the homeless people in Fresno and in other country, in other cities in this country experience. I told them about the bulldozing of the tents and homes of homeless people in Fresno and how they would pick those up and put them into garbage trucks and haul them away, all the possessions these people own.
In fact, that's photographically documented on the same website, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And now the latest thing that they've done here is they've put people in tin cans and called that a solution. They've built these sheds, these tool sheds, and they're storing the homeless people in the tool sheds.
Giving a whole new meaning to the warehousing term.
Yeah, doesn't it, though? And then they're, you know, it's this, they're behind barbed wire, cyclone fence. And when I was explaining this to the people in Brazil, they were just appalled. You could just see their eyes, you know, opening wide, and they were like, that's barbaric. I had no idea that conditions were so bad there. And I had to say that, you know, we're just so far behind the movement in Brazil on what, you know, our response is, and what the movement is able to do in Brazil is just inspiring to me to see that people actually come together and take over land. And not only have they done that, but they've also created schools where people who have taken over the land, then they go to a school, like a college that they've set up, and they learn about how to run a co-op, how to fix machinery, how to market their supplies, their products. And they've got all this infrastructure to maintain hundreds, thousands of these land takeovers. And each one that becomes profitable supports the other ones that are just in the process of developing.
Is there also a guerrilla movement in Brazil that's engaging in armed revolution? Or,
you know what? I didn't see any evidence of that. I mean, there may well be, but they weren't talking to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talked to the people who were in, you know, unions and in you know, the MST. I wasn't, you know, people talked about that more as something that had happened during the military dictatorship.
How about right-wing death squad? They're right-wing.
Right-wing death squad?
Right-wing terror movement.
There is, that is a serious problem with the homeless movement and the MST, is that what happens is that the landowners, well, they don't want to give up what land they think they should possess, right? So what they do is they hire these paramilitary groups to threaten and intimidate the people as they're taking over the land. And there have been a lot of murders, a lot of assassinations of people in the MST. And, there's this, that's definitely a problem. And the way they confront that is they try to stay together. They, don't like send people one at a time off to, to go somewhere. They try to do things as collectively as possible all the time.
Do they have armed self?
These armed groups.
Do they have armed self-defense like the Black Panthers here in the 60s?
If they do, again, they're not talking to me about it.
Is it legal to do that?
I didn't see any evidence of it.
Is it legal to do that in Brazil, to own a weapon and to defend yourself?
You'd think so, but I think, in the conversation, the one conversation I had when I directly asked this question of one of the leaders, they said that it's a discussion that they're in the process of having. There's disagreement about how to handle the question. I would assume that some groups there do arm themselves and that some don't. What she said was that we're not in a position to confront militarily the state because they have a whole lot more firepower than we do.
Well, but you are in a position. Let's shift back to the United States in Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
I recently got a call here in Santa Cruz from a woman in the San Lorenzo Valley who talked about problems with the Klan. I'm trying to get her on the show to talk about that. I thought the Klan, to some extent, was a thing of the past. I know that it had been actually active in the Santa Cruz area a decade or two ago, but I wasn't aware that it was still active, and I'm still not sure about that. But do you have problems? I know in Sao Paulo they have death squads run by the police killing homeless children, right? I mean, that's kind of documented, or at least it's been claimed. What's happening in Fresno around the homeless? Is there much violence against them, more so than a year ago? What's happening there?
I have not seen any evidence of direct violence against the homeless here. There may be, and I haven't seen it, but it's not an issue that I've heard come up. The Klan, there are Klan members in this area. There's neo-Nazis and skinheads, but they, they mostly stay under their rock, and you don't see them very much. There was some that came out. There was a gay pride parade a year or so ago. A couple of Klan members came out in their sheets, and were protesting the march. And somebody came and snatched their hood, and there was lots of excitement about that. But as far as them actually doing anything in an organized fashion here, I'm absolutely not aware of it.
How about police repression of the homeless in Fresno? I know you've talked about the bulldozing of homeless encampments. You have a sleeping ban in Fresno. Do you have regular harassment of people who simply are trying to protect themselves at night and to find a place to to exist?
It's my experience about this here is that it's much more institutional than vigilante. I just don't see that there's a vigilante action that's coming from the Klan or from neo-Nazis. It's more of the nature of passing ordinances against panhandling. The city has a series of ads they run occasionally telling people not to give money to the homeless. They have the police have a policy of moving them out of certain areas of the downtown area so that they're, confined to certain particular neighborhoods and they're not in other areas. And the point of that is that they're trying to bring developers in and they're trying to sell this property and put new buildings in, and the homeless having a presence in those areas. I think it's really about money, Robert. They want the developers want to make money, and they see homeless people and poor people in the neighborhood as bringing the value of their property down.
Food
and
not
so
bombs.
They get the police to push them on the other side of Ventura.
Food not bombs, and I guess I see on your website there's mention of food not bombs in Roseville.
Okay.
Imagine you have a food not bombs in Fresno as well.
Absolutely.
And you also there's also mention of, a free radio station opening up, too? I'm looking at...
There's some low-power FM stations that are coming online. We have KXCF, which broadcasts Pacifica from KPFA, and we have local programming on there. Hey, you know, this would be a really good time for me to mention that on Saturday, here in Fresno, we're going to have an alternative and independent media conference.
Uh-huh.
And there are people from all over the Central Valley and even somewhat beyond in the Bay Area, and hopefully some people from Santa Cruz can come to talk about building an alternative independent media network. There will be people here that have low-power FM, people who have the equipment to do a pirate radio station here in Fresno. And we'll also be talking about indie media. We'll have workshops on how to use indie media. We'll have somebody who's giving a workshop on photojournalism and writing. We're trying to build an alternative to the corporate media dominated landscape here. It's just so oppressive in the Central Valley because there's so little alternative media, and so we're trying to build a movement, both print, radio, cable television, public access television, open up some space.
Is it mentioned on your website? Because I don't...
Yeah, if you go to the Central Valley page on Indie Bay, you'll see right at the top in the center, there's a little red
212,
link.
I see a 212 Alternate Media Conference in Fresno.
That'd be it.
Right, and I guess you click on that, and then there's information as to where to go and so forth. And again, for those who are interested, it looks like Saturday from 9 to 5, February 12th, Alternate Independent Media Conference. And it's an article posted by the famous Mike Rhodes.
Hey, that must be me.
That must be you. We're talking to Mike Rhodes in Fresno. Mike, I hope that you write an article about this for Street Spirit, and I hope you are distributing Street Spirit to homeless folks in Fresno, because Street Spirit's a newspaper for those in Santa Cruz who are listening and interested. You can get a copy of that by giving a call to Huff, 423-HUFF. I guess if you contact Becky Johnson, she may be able to put you in touch with the distributor. And that number is 479-9291. Or you can check out the Huff Table downtown on Wednesdays and Thursdays, 6 o'clock, around Borders and or New Leaf. Check both areas. It's New Leaf on Wednesday and Borders on Thursday. Not in Borders, but outside Borders on the sidewalk. So, Mike, is it... I guess this is open to everyone. It doesn't cost anything. It's at Unitarian Universalist Church on Saturday, 4144 North Millbrook in Fresno.
Right. Oh, actually, you could come and it would cost you nothing, but we're asking for it's a sliding scale between $5 and $15, and that includes lunch.
And that's good. You're also going to be on the air on Monday for the infamous homeless marathon, as I understand it. And that, according to the schedule that they've sent out, this is a broadcast live from New Haven, Connecticut, starting at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Valentine's Day. And I guess you are going to, I'm looking to find out when you're going to be on. You are, there's all kinds of stuff on here, ranging from, starts out with a panel of homeless people at 4 o'clock, causes of homelessness at 5 o'clock from Portland, Maine. Frances Fox Piven is on at 6 o'clock. She's a very famous writer who I really enjoy reading, Homelessness and Literature. Then at 8 o'clock, What Happened to Federal Housing Funds? At Street Poetry will be coming up around 10 o'clock, it looks like. Hurricanes and Homelessness at 11 o'clock. schooling homeless children at midnight. Aha, here we are. And then at 1 o'clock, it's Fresno versus Freedom, independent journalist Mike Rhodes, long green spaces as safe spaces. What's that all about?
Well, I was talking to the producer about some of the homeless issues in Fresno, and there's just so many things here that are going on that, you know, we ended up talking a lot about this outdoor drunk tank that they're putting in down by the rescue mission. And it's just one of those things that you just go, you've got to be kidding. You know, how could they do something like that? And so we were talking about how they've you know, put this enclosed facility. It's like a barbed wire, razor wire around the top and cyclone fencing. And their intention is to round up homeless people and put them in there. If they're, like, got a can of beer in their hand, they're going to pick them up and take them down there and put them in for public display. And
it's kind of a return to more traditional methods of the stocks, it sounds like. Know what I mean?
I got a helicopter buzzing over the top
Watch
of my
out.
Head right now, Robert. I can't hear a thing.
You know, Mike, I'm going to have to thank you for this and encourage people to tune in to listen to you at 1 o'clock on, I guess it's going to be on Tuesday morning.
Yeah, that sounds
February
good.
February 15th. And again, please keep me advised. If you want to follow Mike Rhodes' work, you can go to IndieBay.org?
Yeah, IndieBay.org, and then click on the Central Valley button. Can I give your listeners a phone number if
sure.
they want more information about this conference?
Go for it.
It's area code 559-226-0477.
And again, that's 559-226-0477.
Right, that'd be great. And I'd love to have – it'd be great if people from Santa Cruz could come over and join us.
Hey, thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Robert. Talk to you again.
All righty. Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is the last half hour of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And while we're gearing up for it, let's get tuneful.
Bargain of a basement sublet, Laura Pavlov is giving hers up. The soot on her windowsill is killing her geraniums, so she's going to go.
City. Great musical. But now let's get back to business. Today's Good Times has an interesting article. You may have seen it already. It has a half-page picture of John Maurer sitting around in Salinas. John Maurer is a guy who you might have seen a year ago panhandling in front of the Palomar. He had kind of arrangements of pennies in front of him. He also worked for a time at the hot dog kiosk across from Noah's Bagelry. And he was the man who got a ticket for, two tickets actually, for a Fuck the Pigs, parentheses, police, and parentheses, sign. And Becky Johnson wrote a press release about this, which I'm going to read some of, and then I'm going to get a hold of, if I can, I'm going to try to reach Paul Sanford, his attorney, because Maurer was able to defeat these charges in court, and now he's suing the government, the city government and the police department in federal court, thanks to Paul Sanford and attorney Kate Wells. And this is the description of it in the press release that was issued way back in August of 2003. John had only been homeless for about a month when he got the citation. I was homeless for over a year that other time, he told me, and I never got even one citation. Now I've gotten four in only 5 days. Maurer has gotten caught up in a sweep with a 30% rise in citations this year over last year. That was 2003, the year after the Matthews-Rotkin-Kennedy downtown ordinance. Ordinance has passed. Rotkin and Matthews actually weren't on the council when the original Riley Porter stuff came through, but they joined the council and endorsed the ordinances soon thereafter. By the Santa Cruz Police Department, as part of a campaign to rid posh Pacific Avenue of beggars, hippies, homeless people, and unemployed young men, street performers and political tailors were also caught up in the net. The impetus appears to be nervous merchants who have seen a 15% decline in sales from 2002. While common sense tells us that the decline is due to Enron, Arthur Andersen accounting, the unemployment rate, the drop in the stock market, the Iraqi war economy, politicos and merchants can't do anything about these macroeconomic factors which affect their business. But the homeless beggar out there, he can and must be stopped. Whenever rich folks aren't making as much money as they think they should be making, they take it out on the homeless, Wilhelmina pithily commented. She's been homeless a while and does a bit of traveling from city to city. In July of 2002, the Santa Cruz City Council passed a series of ordinances banning frisbee tossing, hacky sacking, and bouncing a rubber ball on the sidewalk, banned unattended backpacks, and expanded the no-sitting zones from 6 feet to 14 feet from a building. They made it illegal to peacefully ask for anything of value after dark, including food and even silent requests. In January, they added the Move-Along Ordinance, January 2003, which forces musicians, street performers, and political tablers to move along after only 1 hour in any location or be arrested. It surprises no one that these laws are being enforced vigorously against homeless people. John Maurer's crime was under a previously passed but equally anti-homeless ordinance. This one banned using profanity while panhandling. Maurer was frustrated with the tickets he had been issued, and after the police threatened to ticket him for unattended property when he had jumped up to open the door of the St. George Hotel, it was actually the Palomar Hotel, for a woman in her 80s using a walker, he decided to do something. It was then I put this little sign in my hat, Maurer explained. It was a political expression. When Maurer returned to the bucket with his unwanted pennies question mark sign on it, the FCPD cited him on the profanity charge, because he had this Fuck the Pigs sign in his hat. Activist Robert Norris tried to raise the issue at City Council in May, that's me, of course, wearing a Fuck the Police t-shirt in solidarity. In response, Mayor Emily Riley turned off his microphone, directed the cameras be turned away from him, and ordered him away from the podium. Norris's complaint that Riley had denied him the right to speak at City Council and violated the State Brown Act was denied by the City Council in closed session. Local attorney Paul Sanford, seeing the clear content-based First Amendment issue in the citation, offered to represent Maurer pro bono. But when he made arrangements for the arraignment, he discovered something even more disturbing. Normally not much happens at an arraignment. Perry Mason never broke down a witness at an arraignment. The person pleads guilty or not guilty, and in the latter case, the judge sets a trial date. But tomorrow, and this is the actually the day before the arraignment, this press release was issued, things might be more interesting. I found out that the city is not sending anyone to the arraignment as prosecutors, Sanford reported. District Attorney Bob Lee's policy is that he will not prosecute Santa Cruz City ordinances, especially the downtown ordinances. The city prosecutes those, but in the case where the city doesn't show up, the judge becomes both the trier of fact and the de facto prosecutor, an obvious conflict of interest. When Sanford called City Attorney John Barisoni's office, he was surprised and a little upset that they were too busy to come to the arraignment. Sanford doesn't think that is right. He doesn't think it's legal either. On Tuesday morning in Commissioner Irwin Joseph's court, he just might take that up. And I think actually he did. And I'm actually giving him a call right now to see if I can reach him on the air to talk further about the whole Maurer case. He may not be home, however, he may be elsewhere, in which case I'm going to try to reach him at another phone number. And we'll see if we can get through on this. It looks like he's not answering his home phone, so I'm going to try him on his cellular phone and see if we can get through. And we'll see where we're at. Let's see how we're doing here. Let's see if we got we're ringing away here.
Hi, this is Paul Sanford.
Hey, Paul.
Please leave me a message. I'll get back to you as fast as I can. Thank you.
At the tone, please record your
looks
message.
Like we're
when you finish recording,
probably out of luck here, but we'll see what we can
do. Press
1
for more options. To leave a callback number, press 5.
Hey, Paul. This is Free Radio calling in. If you want to try to reach the studio before 8 o'clock, give a call to 427-3772, and we might be able to get together here. Thanks a lot. So there's the story in the Good Times is interesting. John apparently has moved out of town. He's moved into a group home for other HIV positive people, and he's still pursuing this case. The point for me with this issue, it had to do the law he was charged with violating by the city was. Panhandling using profane language. And, of course, the word profane itself kind of sounds archaic and obscure and vague, and it certainly is. And that was one of the concerns that Attorney Paul Sanford had. But, of course, my concern is that people like Pam Bechtel, who were harassing him, not specifically under this law, but her harassment was one of the reasons that he put that little sign in his hat, because she harassed him for opening the door of the Palomar Hotel to, I think it was an 81-year-old woman, an aging woman, and he was helping her with her walker. She was going into the hotel, and Pam threatened to ticket him for unattended property because he left his little penny display behind to do that. This is the kind of pettiness that is regularly imposed against poor people downtown, and you hear me playing accounts of it from people downtown. You make up your own mind as to whether folks are making it up or whether they are omitting key facts. But I've been sufficiently concerned about it that I am, as I mentioned perhaps earlier in the show, I would like to see a Bechtel watch organized. That is to say, a group of cop watchers who specifically keep an eye on and document the activities of CSO Pam Bechtel downtown and interview the people that she has contact with to determine if, in fact, A, they're aware of their rights, and B, they feel good about the kinds of contact she's had with them, and then finally C, whether she is actually enforcing real laws, or rather her sense of what is fitting behavior on Pacific Avenue, whether it's illegal or legal. Because I've noticed her doing that on a number of occasions. And I feel that, of course, that's really the epitome of what a police state is. And in a way, of course, that's what we have in many American cities. We don't really have people, you know, police really following the law. We have police just doing what they want and then pulling a law out of the law book to arrest a person or to cite a person. And, you know, how many of us have the time, the energy, and the resources to go to court and fight this stuff? And even, you know, even if we do, you got to get an attorney or you have to do research the law yourself. You have to deal with a court system that is predisposed to believe the police. The district, you know, even the public defenders work regularly with the police, but certainly the prosecution does. And it's reached the point of such corruption in Santa Cruz. You may remember last week or the week before we had Richard Quigley on. This is the motorcycle helmet guy who's fighting to have the right to have his own kind of helmet on. And whatever you think of that struggle, my concern, you may remember at the time, was that four California Highway Patrol officers, by his account, lied about whether he had something on his head. They didn't say, well, we didn't like the helmet he had in his head. They said he had nothing on his head. And, in fact, he had a tape recording which apparently documented the fact that he did have something in his head because the officers were referring to it as they talked. And the prosecutor, Gretchen Brock, I believe her name is. Maybe I have that one wrong, but Gretchen is her first name. She brought in one lying CHP officer after another, and then had no problems later on raising the same phony story, which, to his credit, Judge Barton tossed out. He said, I found that he had something on his head. He didn't have nothing on his head. He had what he regarded as a cap on his head. And the issue as to what's actually going to happen in that helmet law case is still, of course, being decided. That he's been, Quigley has been told by Judge Barton to go back, and it's a correctable violation. And this, of course, has caused some controversy because Judge Art Ganner ruled earlier it wasn't a correctable violation, and the Highway Patrol is now, you know, mustering ranks behind the decision that it's not a correctable violation. You can't go in and get your helmet signed off and all that. But the point here is rather the kind of perjury, apparently, that is tolerated in our courts. And that, to me, is frightening. It's chilling. And yet, at the same time, I'm kind of jaded because I've seen it before. You know, I've seen officers like Bechtel stretching the truth, misstating things about specific facts about tickets they've given. And it angers me. It angers me. It doesn't really disappoint me because, frankly, I don't really expect honesty from police officers, and that's kind of, maybe that's a sad thing. I mean, I'd like it when it comes, but I've reached the point where I don't really expect it. I don't necessarily expect dishonesty, but I expect that, you know, I mean, often you get a lot of honesty from police officers. I'm not saying that they are as regular dishonesty as a matter of course, but unfortunately, there's so little sanction of police officers, so little punishment or consequence in court for dishonesty. As, for example, in the case of these four Highway Patrol officers, Judge Barton may have upheld Richard Quigley, but he sure didn't throw out